Hi, I'm Kirsty Rice, and I am totally crap at podcast introductions, but I'm reasonably good at expat life and travelling with kids. This is my friend Nikki Moffat.
Hi.
We're the two fat expats, perhaps a little bit literally or maybe even metaphorically, but mostly because we believe that expat life should be lived large. We want you to fill it up to the brim until it's overflowing. Nikki and I are serial expats.
Yep, I've lived in four countries over the last 14 years, which has meant I've climbed Kili in Africa, played tennis in the deep American South, surfed my way around Durban while mastering dumplings and banking in Hong Kong. I can speak taxi Cantonese, I can add some hard R's when needed, and I'm currently touching up my high school German, and I do have a dirndl in my wardrobe.
I've lived in seven countries over the past 17 years and have managed to have a few children along the way. Four kids, four different countries, and I haven't broken one of them yet. I still can't pack a suitcase properly, but a few career highlights have been protests in Jakarta, backyard monkeys in KL, and making my way around the funky cold Medina in Libya. There's been bumps and hurdles in my expat life with chemo in Qatar and boarding school for big kids, but we've made it. I've finally found an online gig that allows me to travel. Only took me about 12 years. Easy, really.
And that's why we're here. Each week we talk about expat life and try to find solutions to expat questions. Now, let's get on with the show.
Hello, Nikki Moffat. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you, Kirsty Rice. How are you this drizzly Hamburg day?
I'm far, far, far from drizzly. I'm piping hot. In fact, it's still hot, hot, hot. It hasn't cooled down one iota in Qatar yet, but I reckon we're getting close. We're surely getting close.
Yeah, I remember in Hong Kong, it used to be somewhere in October, you'd just wake up one day and the humidity wouldn't be 95% anymore. And you'd just be like, yes. It's just that feeling. It's just the day that you know that you can wear your jacket to work and it's fine.
Okay, so this week we're going to do what's hot in the group very, very quickly because we're going back to, we're going old school again, and we're going to throw in an interview and focus in on a topic for our hot topic. So just quickly though, what was hot in the group this week?
Our friend MSMG Emery seems to be getting all her questions out of the way before she moves, and she's put some beauties in the group. This week was about how to transfer money from your home country to the one you're living in, and when you're being paid in one country and living in another and moving the money around. Well, which is the age-old question, right? How do you move money? So how do you move money, Kirsty? Do you get paid in one country? Or you get paid in two countries, right? Because you have two people with two jobs in two different countries.
Yes, yes. So we work on the proviso that the moment we get paid in this country, we get it out. So that's a very fast exchange, and we have bank accounts in Australia. But of course, I get paid in Australia because I work for an Australian company. So the money that my husband gets paid, he moves from, you know, his, well, it's our joint account, but he moves it. I could, I guess, jump in there and do it for him to make his life easier. I probably should jump in there and do it for him, but I don't. What about you, Nikki? I've got a feeling you're moving the money in your household.
I am moving the money. I like to control the cash. I am moving the money, and I have in the past, we've had accounts where we've had multi-currency accounts, so you can move it from one currency into another within the same account. So that's quite helpful. Sometimes I just move it through the bank, so from one bank account to another. And since recently, people have said that actually costs you more. So the bank charges more fees, and you don't get a great exchange rate. So I have been using lately TransferWise, which is one of those things that you can use to transfer money. So yeah, that's my story. We don't transfer a lot of money out. I don't want to. But when we do transfer money around, because we do have bank accounts in various countries for various reasons.
Yeah, and I guess I should say for those that are wondering why we move our money immediately, it's because we're in a country that if anything went wrong, our bank accounts would be frozen. So we don't really have a savings account here. We bank with HSBC. That is not a plug, but we bank with them. And
very mixed reviews.
Yes, we have about 7 different bank accounts because we're those people that say, okay, this much money for this, this much money for this, this much money for this, this much. You know, we really do break it down for our Qatar living expenses, whether it's kids sport or
holiday,
you know, the bills. But yes, we break it down into those expenses so that it's all very simple, which is very much a barefoot investor way of life as well, who happens to be my boss. So I don't think I could not do it that way now. What were some of the reactions in the group though, Nikki? Did anyone have some good tips for how they transferred money?
Well, some people did talk about being paid in one country and living in another, because there are some countries that it's very difficult to get money out of and into, and China is one of those countries. I've lived in another one of those countries, South Africa, also tricky country. Best ever internal banking system. My husband could call me and say, oh, the credit card's maxed out because you have a very low credit card limit. I need to pay for something, and I could sit on my computer and pay it, and he could immediately use the credit card. Amazing internal banking systems. External, not great. Can't really get money out of the country except in your suitcase, and you're not meant to do that. Don't do that. Not encouraging that.
It sounds like us in Libya, because they only had like the Libyan dinar in Libya, but if you wanted to purchase certain things, you needed US dollars, and there were no US dollars in the country. So you would, go for your weekly, not weekly, but you'd go for a weekend escape to Malta and come back with 10,000 US dollars, because you were wanting to buy a car, and you'd have it stuffed in your socks and in your knickers and in your bras and all over the place so that you could take it to the man with one eye and a limp so that he could do some dodgy deal with it. But
all right, in the interest of time, I think we need to move on. So what else was hot in the group this week?
I thought it was interesting that expat divorce came up again with Autumn, and she had said, did anyone have any experience with expat divorce in here? I have some questions. And of course, we've covered this in the podcast before, and we'll put it on the website for people to have a look, because we've got sort of 2 other episodes. One is expat divorce and one is sort of losing your kids within, your expat life. But I thought, it was just good to see the camaraderie between women, yeah. but that there were other women talking about, they'd been through a horrific expat divorce in France. The best advice was to get a good lawyer ASAP. Another woman said she flew home to get divorced because the laws were better for her in her home country, and that she was just lucky that her ex cooperated with it. That she did say she would have put him in jail otherwise, with a really lovely little smiley face, I think. And Katie said she was going through it right now. She was a Brit currently living in the US, that they were separated for now and using mediation to sort of go through it all. But she talked about the nervousness of it all and, the confusion that comes with it. And someone also put a link for a divorce coach.
I saw that.
I'd never thought about a divorce coach, but of course, makes sense.
And the other thing that people said was try and find people going through the same thing or having been through the same thing as you, because it's really important to sort of get that feeling of people going through the same experience, which, as with everything expat, there's something always a little bit different about when you do that.
Yes. Now, Nikki, I haven't spoken to you about living in limbo for a long time. Now, I think it was a year ago that you were told that your husband's company had been bought out and you were unsure about whether you were going to move or not move. What's the deal with you now? Like, what's happening now?
Well, at the moment, we've been told that the settlement for the sale of the company will be in November. That's my understanding. I think that's public knowledge. No, it is. I'm kidding. And that is 1 year since we found out, which was the timetable that was presented at the time. My husband's currently working with a lot of people in the new company on all sorts of transition teams. And whenever he comes home from a meeting, I give him the third degree. And he still doesn't have anything concrete yet. So we're guessing that after the sale is finalized, then the new organizational charts will be rolled out, and then we'll have a bit of a better feeling and understanding about it. But we do have some guarantees in terms of, you know, compensation for hanging around during this uncertain time, and if we hang around for a little bit in the future. So that's always makes you feel a little bit better. But I'm not the only one going through it, Kirsty. A2?
Yes, because we did have someone post about living in limbo and that they were unsure. And was anyone else feeling the same way? And I promptly put my hand up and said, yes, me too, because all of my sentences start with, well, you know, we'll make a decision about that in, you know, November, December, when we know a little bit more about what's going on. And it's everything, absolutely everything, whether it's something as simple as, wouldn't it be great to have a curtain up in front of that door so the neighbours can't see me getting changed at night, to, you know, should we buy my son a new hoodie for school, you know, that's the right size because he's only got a few months left possibly, who knows? Lots and lots of things, you know, the garden, the everything. It's like, oh, don't plant that. It's that whole don't plant any roots just in case, you know, don't pay a huge gym membership, don't invest too much into this in case you know. So our situation right now is we've been told maybe November, December. We were meant to know back at the beginning of the year, and then it was pushed to June, and then June was pushed to December. And then I said to my husband yesterday, is there any possibility that they may push this date again? And he said, sure, anything's possible. Absolutely. So, yes, I very much live in limbo. And, you know, in our group there was quite the kerfuffle because the person who asked said, you know, should I move this, should I move that, should I take this, should I take that? And they said, you know, do we take the dog or not? And I feel by way of explanation I need to explain what's happening in the Middle East at the moment. For you to move your dog to another country right now, kid, if it is a dog that's over 15 kilos, I think it is, it can cost you up to $20,000.
Yeah, which was part of it. And I don't want to go into it, but we had to leave a dog when we left the US. Now, I think I've told that.
You're going to get hate mail.
And I think I've told the story before. But look, we left Australia. We left our two dogs living in our house. Our renters took our dogs on. We moved from a house with a big yard to a tiny apartment in Hong Kong. We weren't going to take our dogs with us. We had no way of knowing whether that was appropriate for them. And it was much better for them to stay in the house they knew and loved and for our renters to get a fantastic discount on their rent. And in the US, we had a situation where we said, no, we're not getting a dog. No, we're not getting a dog. No, we're not getting a dog. You don't understand. We don't want to leave any dogs behind. And then we got a dog, and then we immediately found out we were moving. We had the dog for 12 months, and we had about 15 people that wanted to take him. We wanted to bring him with us, but unfortunately we had signed a contract, a binding contract, with someone about breeding him, and they weren't letting us out of the contract. So that's the situation we had. So every situation is different. Love dogs. I love dogs. No hate mail. Thank you.
Yeah, that's one of those accounts we have in the bank where we're putting money into dog transportation. Anyway, Nikki, I digress. There was one last comment I wanted to mention that I just loved on the page. And someone was talking about moving from hot to cold. And, you know, from me to you, Nikki, would be a great example of that because I'm currently sitting in 45 degrees with sunshine that glares into my face and you're in the drizzle in Hamburg. But a woman had asked about moving from Southeast Asia to Moscow, I think it was.
Oh, yes.
And she said, more importantly, will we freeze to death? My daughter gets hypothermia in the refrigerated section of the grocery store. I thought that was gold. Yeah. Okay, hot topic of the week. Nikki, we wanted to talk about female expats who have moved with their career, where they have been the lead in that move, and what it's like when you're a woman who's working and you're there for your work permit, your visa, and you have a partner that you take along with you, and what that looks like. There was actually an interesting article in the Financial Times this week that kind of touched on women still hesitating to accept foreign assignments. Did you read that one?
I did read that. That was shared by Anna with our group, and Anna is a member of the Two Fat Expats group living in Ethiopia. So shout out to Ethiopia.
Yay! That's somewhere I'm definitely going to go.
Yeah, I did read that, and it was so interesting. It said, it was written by a lady called Helen Barrett, who I think is writes about education, tertiary education or further education, and women. Women accounted for 25% of foreign work assignments in 2016, according to the Global Mobility Trends Survey. And two decades ago, that portion was 10%. Now, I would think that sounds high to me. I'm glad it's 25, and I'm glad that it's increasing, but I wouldn't have thought 25% of women are foreign work assignments. What do you think?
I'm wondering if it's because when you consider younger women in a survey like this, that would bump your percentage up. I would like to see an age group of when that changes with women with children, because I think, Nikki, you know, you and I both started travelling when we were pregnant or with child, and it affects, you know, because you're starting to move into that play groups and schooling and who you're hanging out with. Whereas I think so many more younger women now travel for their work, you know, 20s to 30s. And I know we have a huge amount of young professional women here in Qatar who work that do not, you know, that I don't see in my day-to-day, you know,
oh my God,
school suburbia.
I was being ageist. I am so sorry. I'm too old. Yay. Woman power. I'm all for it, whichever way it comes. Yeah. And then so one of the reasons listed in the article was women's reluctance to accept foreign assignments is causing problems. More than a third of employers questioned said they were struggling to create gender-balanced senior leadership teams because women were turning down placements abroad, often because they were reluctant to disrupt the careers of their spouses or partners.
Yes.
Women. Women.
Yes. Interrupt his career. Go ahead, interrupt it. What does that tell us, Nikki? What does that tell us? Does it tell us that women have more respect for their partners' careers, or does it show you that you know, the spouses, you know, the female spouses of the working male are happier to throw caution to the wind? What does it say about us?
I don't know what it says about us, but I think, and I discussed this in the interview that you're going to hear shortly with Julie, I think that there just needs to be just a repositioning of the discussion. If one person wants to move and they're the lead spouse, it doesn't matter. You know, just take the job. If women are being offered overseas assignments, it's obviously reasonable job roles, and they should just go for it, I say.
Does it say something to the pay scale imbalance as well? Like, does it mean that, you know, because we know that men still traditionally earn more than women, is it saying that women who move, who have a partner who's earning as much or more, are like, well, no, that's a huge impact if my partner loses his job and the affordability of the move? So you spoke to Julie. Tell me what Julie does for a living.
I don't know what Julie does. I just spoke to Julie about being the lead expat and what her experience was. Julie is originally from North Carolina, and she moved a few years ago to Saudi Arabia with her job role. Do you want to listen?
I do want to listen. Is she still living in Saudi Arabia, or has she moved?
She's not still living in Saudi Arabia. After, I think, 2 or 3 years in Saudi Arabia, she decided that they would like to have a change. They would like to stay expats, and they would like to stay somewhere warm. So Julie has found another role in Abu Dhabi, and that's where she moved a few months ago.
Fantastic.
We moved to Saudi Arabia about 3.5 years ago. It was our first expat experience. And it was for my job, and it was a great experience. We wanted kind of that life adventure. So we have always looked at this overseas adventure as kind of a team sport, no matter who the the lead person is. It's, you know, kind of a team family effort. We have two kids. And that was great. But then we preferred to live in the Emirates for various reasons. And I got a new job over here just recently. So this was a different move. My husband was able to work while we were in Saudi Arabia, which was great. And we're not sure how that's going to play out here. It's still kind of an unknown. We're only a couple months into this. And so he's getting the family settled and our dog finally arrived and all of those things that the non-working parent usually takes on. So he's been focused on that. And I've been getting going on the job here. It's a new job. It's not like it's a transfer within a company.
How is it different, do you think, for you between the Saudi Arabia time and your time in Abu Dhabi?
We're loose here. You know, we're in a big city, kind of finding our way on our own, whereas everything was kind of manufactured for us in Saudi Arabia. You know, we lived on a compound that was fully dedicated to my place of employment. So we were sheltered from a lot of things and kind of lived in this isolated existence, which was fairly easy, quite honestly. And here we're in a city, we're finding our own housing, you know, picking the children's schools, a lot more of that typical startup expat thing that we've never really had to deal with before. So, and socially, you know, it's harder to get connected because we have all these various groups. We're not just all isolated together in one place.
When you say your husband was able to work in Saudi Arabia, he got a job when he got there, or?
Yeah, within my place of employment, they help spouses. They facilitate that for the trailing spouse and help find work and all within the same organization. Within a month, there was really very little downtime. So startup there was very easy for us. You know, it was, here's your house, the kids are going to this school, this is where you're working, and here's a job for your husband, you know, bing, bang, boom, everything's done, quick.
That's very
you know,
handy.
So that, you know, which is perfect for our first overseas, because we were new to this whole thing, so, you know, when everything's laid out for you like that, it makes it very easy. Yeah, it was a very unique circumstance, right? Not probably most people's typical Saudi Arabia experience. We were in kind of a unique situation, but yes, it's not normal, I don't think.
You went great. We love the expat gig. This is looking good for us. We'd like to maybe go to the Emirates because it offers similar yet slightly different things. I'm going to find a new job. And you did that.
Yep.
So one of the things, sure, I think you said in your message was that you're finding it difficult in terms of schools and connections. In Saudi Arabia, how did that work?
Well, everybody that lived in this compound all went to the same school, and most everybody had dual parents working because this organization facilitated that. So it was kind of the norm to have two working parents. So it was a very easy arrangement. And like I said, socially, everybody's all right there, kind of experiencing almost identical things. So it's much broader. We've only been here 2.5 months. So we're still, I mean, I'm kind of going through the throes of this all right now. You know, in fact, so you're getting it connected with the school is challenging. Everything is during the working day. I even wanted to volunteer at the snack shop on the weekends for athletic events, but all the trainings are during the week, which I can't do. So it's just challenging to get connected. And the few events they do have in the evenings, there just isn't a big turnout for that because everybody's all talked out.
And how's your husband finding it different, knowing that he's not sort of guaranteed a job, that it's a different kind of process?
Yeah, definitely. And so for me, like I was saying when we first started talking, I mean, I have the job. I'm distracted. I can meet colleagues through work. I've got something I'm doing every single day. So whether or not I'm raging in the social scene at the school, you know, that's okay, because I have other things going. But for him, you know, this is what he's doing. He's getting the family settled and he's finding his way. And I think that's more difficult for him. I mean, he's handling it well. He's a team player in every aspect, so I couldn't ask for a better partner in all of this. But it is hard when I think there was only one other dad that he's ever seen kind of roaming around the schools during the day. But he's finding his ways with, you know, coaching soccer and volunteering with the school and getting more involved in those areas where he can really contribute. But it's hard, you know, and eventually he hopes to find a job. And that's what now he's starting to explore that now that we're a little bit more settled. But it's a little bit more daunting, I would say, in this kind of environment.
Is he looking to expand his social circles during the day, or is he just going to concentrate on looking for work?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think right now, I mean, we're still challenged where he doesn't even have a visa yet. So there's really not much he can do on the work front yet. So I think he's kind of focusing right now on the social piece and connecting with more of the kids, the parents of our kids, maybe friends, and focusing on ways he can volunteer at the school and contribute and just feel, you know, valued and engaged that way. So I think right now that'll be his focus. In another couple months, he'll probably transition that back over to kind of the job hunting thing.
So you talked about in Saudi Arabia, for instance, how you found a great group of mums and working mums, and you had a regular evening event.
Mm-hmm. I think in my mind, that would be what I would be working towards, because I just don't fit that full-time home mom mold. I don't, you know, socially, I've tried that in the past. My oldest is 12, so I've kind of been at this working mom thing for a long time. And it's no, you know, everybody makes different choices, and I'm not, there's no knock on it. Like, it's not necessarily a jealousy thing. It's just a social ability thing. So I think finding that those other people that are like me, that are dealing with the same challenges of working full time and having kids in the school and all these other same things I'm going through. So that's probably my primary objective, is to kind of tap into that professional women network who are also moms, preferably, just so we can, you know, be relatable and find some social outlets that way. That's probably my main goal, because that really worked great for me in Saudi Arabia, having that community of women that I could really relate to. I mean, I still want to meet the other moms at school, and especially the moms of my kids' friends and that type of thing. But from a finding my girlfriend network, I think that's really kind of the way I would go about it.
And you said that people ask you all the time, what does your husband do?
Oh, constantly. Oh, the first few weeks, everything, they come up to me, what does your husband do here? And then it's, you know, it's, I laugh. It's understood. I get in a small percentage here. You know, but for him too, people come up to him, what do you do? What's your job? What brought you here? That kind of thing. So, you know, it's fine. It's awkward and a little bit strange, and it makes people a little bit uncomfortable sometimes once they realize the arrangement. But it is what it is. I understand we're a smaller percentage of people here. Like you said, maybe that number is growing, but it, you know, after a while it does get a little bit exhausting.
When you say to people, well, I'm here, we're here for my job, what's the response that you get?
Yeah, it's generally, oh, you know, kind of surprise and then curiosity. So it's not, you know, poorly received. I don't, you know, I don't think I get any negative responses. And I don't get real hung up on this kind of stuff either. You know, I'm fine with that. Yeah, I don't have time for that. Exactly. I think what is more awkward again for my husband is, you know, it's like an accepted thing. If a trailing mom, for instance, chooses not to work, it's fine. No biggie. Right. But for my husband, it's always well, are you looking, or what are you going to do? Like, yeah. Whereas it's perfectly acceptable if the mom doesn't do it, you know, then nobody's going to quiz her. Like, well, aren't you going to go get a job? You know, nobody would ever ask a female that. So for him, I think that's a little bit, I think that's frustrating. And I see it and I get frustrated with it, because as soon as they realize this, the arrangement, it's like, well, what are you doing? Surely you're going to go work. You know, that's annoying. And it's that double standard as well.
It's where we need to reframe the conversation globally. If only one person's going to work, doesn't matter which person it is. It's a private conversation. Just, it's in their household.
Right. It's just the stigma associated with it. So, and I'll say one last thing about it too. I think the hard part with working moms too, I'm so much more plugged into, you know, I did all the school applications and all the research piece, you know, stuff that, you know, I can't let go of so easily. So I think that's, you know, and trying to connect with the friends. So in a way, I think we take on more than we should, as opposed to letting a lot of that go to my husband, for instance.
Oh, wow. That was fantastic. I don't want to start at the end first, but that last bit at the end really spoke to me about how there's still so much she thinks she does, even though she is the lead expat.
Yes, and that's like the mental load that you were talking about from one of your current favourite podcasts, which was Ladies We Need to Talk, and the episode about the mental load and how the woman or the female in the partnership often carries that, regardless of their work requirements. Yeah. I loved everybody, Julie and everybody in the group who commented, said they always get asked, so what does your husband do?
Yeah, isn't that? And that was also in that article that was in the Financial Times, was that the woman that they featured got so sick of that was the opening question, you know, what's your husband doing here? Because it was just assumed that she was there with her husband.
Yeah, so I think it's great. And wow, how about the Saudi Arabia setup, though? Have you heard about that before? You get a job, then they get your spouse a job, or your kids go to the same school, you all live in the same area. Is that unusual, or have you heard about that before?
Oh, see, I didn't see that as a Saudi thing. I saw it as her company, that's what her company did.
Ah, okay. All right. Could be true. Yes, I saw that, sorry, as her company doing it in Saudi Arabia. But I just meant what a way to land on your feet on your first expat assignment. I mean, it's pretty good.
Yeah. I know the company my husband used to work for, they also did the same. They had a very strong policy for finding spouses employment and would go to the nth degree, anything that they could do to help find, to get a spouse back to school or to study while they were on their assignment or to find a job. And they actually had like a job network, like a board that you could go to see sort of jobs that were available. But of course, you know, there's all the usual things that fly into that of, you know, how long are you going to be there, how invested do you get, you know, people employing people that are moving, you know, all the same sort of stuff, people being aware that it's just inverted commas grocery money for one person because they know the other person's there on the package. It's complicated, but yes, it is still a fantastic initiative, and that would have been amazing to be able to walk into that and have that happen.
And I also thought, which I shouldn't have thought, but I also thought how amazing. They loved their life. They enjoyed being in the Middle East, and they thought, okay, we want to stay here, but we want to go somewhere else. So she just went out and got another job. And I guess that's what people do, right? That's what people do. But I just, for some reason, I think it's a greater achievement when a woman does it, which I shouldn't do. But I just thought, wow, I don't know. Maybe I've been out of the workforce for too long.
No, I think that's a big achievement for anybody. I don't care if you're a woman or not. I always think it's amazing that anyone can move from one country to another and get themselves another job. It's not easy to do. You know, that's why not everybody does it. It's not a simple, oh, I'm working in Mexico, I think I might go and work in Spain now. Oh, I'm in Spain, I think I might go to Indonesia. Do you know, especially, yes, it's fine if you're getting moved within a company from one place to another. That's just being transferred. But yeah, packing everything up and getting another job, yeah, kudos to her. I thought, I was interested, Nikki, to hear what you thought about Julie saying about wanting to find a professional women's network, because I did find that unfortunate that happens in the world of women. Of yeah, it's great to talk to the mums at school, and of course I want to be friends with my kids' friends, mothers, but I'd like to have a professional group of women that understand what I'm going through. Do you know? And I always think back to, I had a couple of years off when I had my fourth, oh, well, no, I lie. I had 5 months off when I had my fourth child, but I had been at home for a little while before, and I'd made a lot of friends at the school. And I always think there's no way I could have successfully gone back to work without my mum friends I'd made from school, because it was those women that helped me out, that, you know, when I was running late or when there was a drama, they would say, that's cool, I'll pick her up, or I'll drop him off, or I can do this, or I can get them to dance, or I've picked up that form for you, do you know, all that stuff. And they were still my great friends. I didn't feel that we suddenly weren't the same anymore.
I understand what you're saying, and I agree with it. I also understood what she was saying, because I talked some of the stuff that I cut out in my excellent editing was that I had a conversation with her about when I lived in Hong Kong, in my social circle, there were three of us who worked full time, as in women who worked full time, and most of the other girls I knew didn't work full time. They were at home most of the time with the kids. And when we went out to dinner and stuff, the three of us gravitated towards each other. We weren't better friends or anything. It's just if we were sitting at a table, we'd sit together probably or stuff like that, just because we probably had more in common, you know, dealing with work and kids and school. No, wasn't anything against the others. It was just how it was sometimes. I don't know. That's kind of what I think about that.
And now that you're not working in a traditional working role, if you were to meet a woman who worked 9 to 5 and she was to tell you that she was looking for other female friends that work 9 to 5, would that alienate you at all? Like, would you think, oh, do you think I have nothing to offer? Or
no, because that's part of my many groups of friends philosophy. I would still think I could be her friend, because that's how naive I am. But I would also think, sure, I'm okay with that. I understand where she's coming from. if I had never had that experience, then maybe I wouldn't understand. But for me, I get it.
Oh, yeah. But you would still think, oh, we can still be friends. You wouldn't take it personally as, oh, she doesn't think she can be my friend, because you're an eternal optimist of...
Well, maybe 10 or 15 years ago I would have felt differently. But now I'm old and apparently ageist towards all the young people moving around without families. Yes, now I wouldn't take it personally. I'm fine with that.
Yeah, because I have to say, I have had times in my life, obviously not now because I'm really happy with the career that I've structured for myself, but I would say that probably when I had small children and vomit on my shoulder, not my own, obviously my child's, but, you know, it was running around with a diaper bag and or a nappy bag and, you know, struggling to sort of get my act together, I probably would have felt a little bit alienated by that. I think that that's why that sort of mum divide happens, do you know, because those sort of conversations get had.
Yeah, look, I understand what you're saying as well. I'm not disputing it. I'm saying we agree. I like to agree with people too, but I also can still see the other side. Anyway, loads of great commentary from the group. Now, there was another interview that I had lined up, but we ran into some technical problems due to Sky and the region. And then just because she was a busy working mom, we couldn't get round to it before today. But that was Karen, and I think you know Karen Kirsty. But she posted in the group fabulous, fabulous commentary. And it was very long and very detailed. She said she's met a few other women whose family have moved because of her job, but it's not, so she knows it's not really unusual. But here in the sand pit, where she lives in Doha, it still surprises some, and rarely, but yes, sometimes women who don't work treat me differently, which I thought was very telling.
Yes, because she went on to say about school and how the teacher-parent meetings and events were always scheduled in the middle of the afternoon or morning. And she said even after 4 years of telling them that both her and her partner worked, they still tell her to come in at 2:40, which I notice all the time in international schools, and it drives me batty because they do just assume that there's only one partner working and that we can all work around it and do it. Nothing is ever organised in the evenings. And I know that is not the case for my child's school in Australia. Like, most things are for parents are arranged in the evenings because they just, you know, assume that both are working. So, yeah, it's a definite thing. Interesting that Karen feels that way about women talking or treating her differently, and because that does sort of touch on what we were just saying before, doesn't it, about the different mum groups. But I know Karen personally, she's a great friend, she's an amazing woman with the most incredible career that allows her to travel. She's involved in huge sporting events, you know, like the Olympics, and she goes to amazing things and is, you know, often in one country or another. So, yes, she's done incredibly well. And I wonder, yeah, do people get alienated a little bit by that? Because she's done so incredibly well. She's also vivacious and gorgeous and has a beautiful partner.
The other thing was, which I thought that Julie also mentioned, was that how they have a lot of empathy for their partner, and they say, you know, it is very hard for them, and which I thought was very nice. I don't know if my husband talks about me like that. It's very hard.
Yeah. I totally agree. And I find it all the time is when you speak to the working women, they do have incredible empathy for their partner. But is it because their partners are in the minority? And so it's that, you know, feeling sorry for anyone in the minority because they're having a different level of problem. And I have to say, for Karen's husband, it was really tough for him in that because it wasn't his work permit, his work visa, you know, he just couldn't get anything done, which I find fascinating because most women in the Middle East would tell you that they can't get anything done because they're not men.
Which is great, right? So the whole thing that she went through, he was trying to do all these things. He was contacting the company was saying it's not appropriate for you to contact us. I was like, it's just what a woman has to go through when, so it really doesn't matter if it's male or female, it's just the person in that situation. The person doing all the groundwork, try to put everything together, It's overwhelming. And so, you know, one night he was almost in tears of frustration, which, hello, welcome to my world. And she also said, you know, his self-esteem and confidence and sense of purpose were threatened by our reality. And like some training spouses, he got very lonely. Again.
Oh, hello. Yeah. Can't imagine what that's like.
So I just think, really, when you take the sex out of it, as in male or female, it could be anyone. They're just going through the same thing. It doesn't matter who they are. They're still all going through the same thing. So I think that's...
So are you telling me, Nikki, you feel that women have more empathy in this situation about what their partners are going through than men do about women?
Well, I think you might be trying to put words in my mouth there, Kirsty. What I'm saying is that these two particular women showed a lot of empathy for their partners. And I can't say that I've always heard the same amount of empathy from male people that I listen to speak about it.
Oh, no. And I think maybe it's an issue with that traditional gender roles where perhaps people assume that women will be able to run a house and a house's administration and children and everything else that comes with it. And then it's like, well, you know, it's like men who get told they're babysitting their own children when they're not babysitting, they're parenting.
So Renee says that people always assume it's his job, the movements. In a parent-teacher meeting once, they asked my husband questions about what time he comes home and how often he has to travel. And they didn't ask me any of those questions. Which is, hello.
Is it kind of like that thing when, you know, your husband can travel 80% of the time and you're at home, you know, looking after everything and handling everything, and then you go home to do a job and your husband, you have friends that deliver food to his door or invite him for dinner because he's probably struggling. Do you know?
That is so true. And how when you leave like a detailed like project management plan about who has to be where, when, and what foods might be available, and, you know, how it all works, where the spare key is. But hello, all those things just have to be.
And someone sees your husband out and about parenting one of your children and you get a note saying, oh, my God, your husband's amazing. He's amazing. I saw him at the supermarket today. Incredible.
Oh, dear. So we had a lot of great comments from the group, and we did really enjoy them all. And I think it has put – well, I'm just really, really excited that 25% of foreign work assignments in 2016 are female. Long may that number increase.
Yeah, absolutely. And if that was the jump, if it was truly a 15% jump in the last 10 years, how wonderful would it be if we could have a 20% jump in the next 10 years and, you know, almost get there. And, you know, like you said, Nikki, we're seeing it more and more. We're seeing more and more expat women being the drivers and it being their career that gets them overseas. But, yeah, let's hope that it continues on. Okay, Nikki Moffat, podcasts, what have you got?
Well, Kirsty, I don't know. Are you going to a dinner party this weekend and perhaps feel a little bit underdone for your dinner time conversation?
Why? What do you mean?
Well, no. I listen to a lot of podcasts every week, as you know, as do you. And one of the ones I listen to is The Economist. And, well, the Economist have a lot of podcasts, but one of them is called The Tasting Menu. And it's the tastiest bits from across The Economist platform for the week. And so it takes the best bits from the magazine and from the podcasts and just puts them all into one sort of 15 to 30 minute podcast. So if you're feeling a little bit underdone on current events or news, you should maybe listen to The Tasting Menu from The Economist. Do you listen to
that
one?
That's a brilliant idea. No, I don't. As you know, I live with an economist, which sounds about as exciting as it is. It makes me laugh because it's when people say to him, oh, do you listen to Kirsty's podcast? He'll say, oh, every day's a podcast at my house. But that sounds amazing, and I will be downloading that. I think that's perfect. It's a perfect way to get through The Economist.
It is, and it's just short little articles, and they're very interesting. Anyway, I find it interesting. So sometimes it's news, current events, and sometimes it's sort of one of the bigger, deeper stories, and it's very good. I'm enjoying it. The other thing I listened to this week, and I listened to all the episodes at once, and I really hope there's more coming soon, was one from the ABC Australia called How Do You Sleep at Night?
Yes, yes. Very good.
Have you done that one? Have we done that one here before?
No, we haven't. I don't think we have because I know I had it in the back. You know how there was a few weeks where I was saying, oh, I must talk about that next week, you know, because I'm talking about this. And I think that was one of them, that and Hidden Brain. But yes, I agree with you. The How Do You Sleep at Night? It sort of looks at people that, I don't know, for want of a better term, you know, maybe others see as dodgy, or I don't know. What were you, sorry, I've completely hijacked you. What were you going to say about it?
No, I was going to say it's one of those things. I just think it's really well done. The production is amazing. I really, just listening to it, you can hear all these sounds and the way it just all blends. And I was just like, that's like a podcast. Yeah, utopia. But also the way they do it. So the journalist seeks out people who are sort of on the edge of what society considers the right or wrong of a moral decision. So the first one is about two hunters who are women, and talks about hunting and why they shoot animals. And, you know, it really, you feel conflicted by the end. And in fact, the reporter also feels conflicted by the end. So she goes into it with the point of view that she doesn't like or enjoy hunting, yet at the end when she goes on this all-night stakeout to shoot a deer and they don't get one, she feels sort of ripped off.
Now, Nikki, my podcast listening this week, Dirty John, which I know you finished last week.
Oh, how good.
It was the ending. The last 10 minutes, just shockingly brilliant. So well done. And just,
but did you see that coming?
No. I saw a snippet when they were talking about, and I don't want to give away anything, so they were talking about one of the daughters' television viewing with the partner, and I thought, why have they put that in there? Like, is, and I was thinking when she was talking about a certain gift that she'd bought him, I was thinking, why is that in there? Like, is that gift going to come back? But you realise at the end why it was there. It was to sort of start leading you down a trail. But, I really loved Dirty John. I thought it was great storytelling. I loved the length of the podcast. I loved how many episodes there were. I feel like I'm done. I've had the complete story. I'm dusted. I understand. Do you know, like, it was all nice and neatly wrapped up. It wasn't one of those ones where you still are left wondering 2 years later.
Yes.
Just it was brilliant.
That's the unresolved crime issues, the true crime that never gets resolved. But I have to say, if you do listen to Dirty John and you sort of lose interest about the fourth or fifth episode, keep going, because I think in the fourth episode I thought, oh God, is this ever going anywhere? I had a little bit of a questioning of my commitment to listening, but I'm super glad that I listened to the end.
Do you know, I think that's one of the great things about a podcast on the treadmill, because you're not on a treadmill, you're kind of stuck, right? Because you need to slow down if you're going to change or switch or make a decision. Do you know, you're sort of in that headspace. But yes. Now, one of the other ones I've been listening to is called Where Should We Begin? And it's Audible are now doing podcasts, and they're Audible's big selling point, I guess, with this podcast is come to Audible where you won't have to listen to the ads or do whatever, you know, like you are in our podcast. But this one, Where Should We Begin, is Esther Perel, who is a relationship therapist. And I gather there's going to be 10 episodes because they say they use 10 anonymous couples. But the first one that I listened to was called I've Had Better. And I was talking to my husband about this yesterday because I made him go and listen to it. He said he got about halfway through and he just couldn't do any more. But I said to him, did you feel like you were really invading these people's space, like that you shouldn't have been listening to them? He said, no, I just thought they were terrible people. But the first one is a couple. She is, now, she was a Russian Orthodox. He's an American Muslim. They married. The reason I tell you this is because she converted when they married, you know, for love and because it was something he wanted. They had three children. They, from all accounts, were successful people. She became a stay-at-home mum, and then he had an affair. And you listen to the counsellor, this Esther Perel, who, if the name is familiar, you may have seen her doing TED Talks on relationships, and she's quite well known. She's Belgian, so she has this strong sort of very strong accent that sort of gives her this forthright position in all of the conversations, right? Because she's got that clipped, I'm in control here kind of sound to her. But you listen to these people's therapy of the affair, because you can tell that the woman was incredibly angry and incredibly hurt. And what has rolled on from this affair is that they now live in a relationship where they're more like friends and they're not having sex because I guess the betrayal is too much. But she keeps saying that she's quite happy with where they are right now, and she thinks that maybe this just happens in marriages. And she's talked to a lot of people, and she sees that maybe this is just what happens with people, that people have affairs and they go and do these things and you continue on raising your children and whatever. But there are a couple of things in this that are just brutal. There's this moment where, I guess the things are, you realise that they're not listening to each other. And you start to question your own relationship where you go, do I do that? Do I cut you off like that when you're trying to tell me something? And listening to someone have therapy, you suddenly start to think about your own relationship and things that you might be quite guilty of with your listening skills. And so there's a moment where he talks about the other woman, and the wife says, but you still came to me, as in, you know, we were still having sex while you were doing this. Why were you still coming to me for sex if you were so obviously having sex with someone else and whatever? And he basically says that having sex with her was like having sex with a dead body. And oh, nice. I was just like, oh, yeah. I was just like, oh, you don't come back from that, surely. You can't. How do you ever come back from that? And she was immediately, no, I am not, you know, I'm this. I just found it fascinating, because then a little bit later she says, the therapist asks, well, was the sex okay for you pre-children and, you know, pre all of this, was the sex okay? She goes, yeah, it was good sex. You know, yeah, I've had better. But I was like, oh, my God. Now, I think that would kill my husband. Do you know, I don't know about you and Sam, but I know, I think my husband would be, he would find that very hard to come back from. Do you know, I found it fascinating. Anyway, I just think it's a good one for, if you can get through the, oh, I really feel like I'm in a conversation I shouldn't be a part of because I'm hearing the deep, dark secrets of these people. But I thought it was a really good one for having a look at your own relationships. And when I look back to have a look at the blurb, they actually say that, you know, it can empower you in your own relationships. And I do actually think there was something in that. I thought it was really, really good. Now, books for me, I am just starting The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, because, of course, it's our Two Fat Expats book group this at the end of this month. So I've got that coming. Nikki, have you got anything sort of screen-wise that you're watching?
Screen-wise? Well, I'm watching all my favourite, as they say, fall shows are back. So I've been binging on all those that have restarted, like Grey's and How to Get Away with Murder, all the best shows. But Young Sheldon is a new show. It's pre-Big Bang Theory, so it's meant to be, you know, when Sheldon Cooper was a child. I watched it, I don't know. I'd be interested to hear if anyone else enjoyed it. I was mixed. So, yeah, no, I haven't really found anything great or inspirational or life-changing. So, no, just back to In the Zone. What about you?
Yeah. Well, you know, last week you talked about Liar, which had Anna from Downton Abbey in it, and we talked about what a great story and what about. Now, I know I've seen the shorts to it. I can't remember where I saw the shorts to it, and now I can't find it to watch it. So I went to look on Aussie TV, and I don't think it's getting released until later in the year. So it's not available yet to watch on the network, and I just can't work out where to watch it. So if anyone else is an expat and they're watching Liar, please tell me how you're watching it and where you're watching it so I can go and view it.
Kirsty, hands up. BBC iView? Did you look at that?
Is it so? It's on BBC, is it?
Yes, it's on BBC.
Because I thought it was ITV that it was on.
I don't think so, no. I think it's BBC iView.
Oh, fantastic. Okay, I'm heading to BBC iView then. Thank you. We have finished watching Survivor, Australian Survivor, in our house. That was the grand finale this week. Oh, would that be too much of a spoiler if I say
I don't know, I wasn't watching it.
Watching? Yes. What I will say, though, is, you know, I said before that I thought as the Australian Survivor had finally found its place and it was looking more and more like American Survivor and, you know, no longer like Diet Survivor. It actually looked like Full Strength Survivor. Definitely they had they actually did the thing where they compiled all the votes from the jury and then went back to the studios in Australia and had the host, you know, jet in on a boat, much like, Jeff used to come in on the helicopter and whatever. They did all of that. So it was really good. The finale was fantastic. The reunion show was fantastic. It was really well done. And I just think it's such a good one to watch with your kids. Do you know, your kids can really get into it. They love all the challenges and they love all of that. And you can have a whole family discussion about who you can't stand and why. And yes, my youngest and I were very much opposed to who should win, so we were cheering for different people. Do you know, it was good. We also kicked off with Gogglebox as well, because that's back again, which I've wired on about before. I absolutely love, but I have to say, nothing highbrow for me at all, just general televiewing, which I wonder if that's got something to do with having all the kids in the house and, you know, back to viewing that way. I really can't remember the last time Greg and I sat down and just watched Grown Up something together, because it seems now with teenagers, we've lost that window. You know, that we've lost the window of putting kids to bed and now let's watch. That seems to have disappeared, and it's more, what are we going to watch with the kids where it's, you know, properly rated and everybody's happy to watch it.
Well, we check commonsensemedia.org in advance to ensure that it's totally appropriate for our children.
Yes, but we know that Kirsty doesn't do that, because Kirsty keeps giving people inappropriate choices to make. One other thing that has landed in my news feed, and I wanted to ask you, Nikki, if it had, and I had only thought about this when you were talking about The Economist and that groovy little way of getting the whole snippets of The Economist all in one tasty podcast. But this is in my news feed yesterday. A New York Times ad came up, but it wasn't for the New York Times. It was to get a newsletter with the highlights for the New York Times, and was asking for my, you know, did I want to sign up to do that? And I thought, I haven't signed up as yet because I was sort of doing something else at the time and just, you know, quickly scrolling through. But it is something I would be interested in. I wondered if any of our listeners have done that, but also is that the way we're going, that everyone's going to give snippets of the big picture, you know, to as teasers, because we've all become so insanely bad at holding attention for more than 5 seconds?
Yeah, that we can't do the full thing. Well, that's what the squeeze is, right? So that's what the squeeze is, and the US version as well. They're all just snippets of what you might need to know. It's so when you can go to a dinner party or have a wine and a conversation with someone, that you can argue and neither of you can be right because you don't have the full story.
Yeah, exactly. But I thought that was interesting.
Now on that, I just want to make perhaps not backtrack, but thank you, Kirsty, for your education over the past week, where you've been forwarding me many articles that we've found, that you have found, about women our age drinking and the problems associated with that. So you took my skepticism to heart, and you found it you found a way to educate me and show me studies and articles about that. So I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Can you believe how many, like, it's definitely a hot conversation right now, isn't it?
It is. It is. I agree. And as I said, you can make a statistic say anything, but it's obviously what they're up to these days.
I don't know about statistics, but I do think that, because when I was in my 20s and a massive binge drinker, do you know, like a go out from Thursday to, you know, finishing up with a Sunday session, I actually never had alcohol in the house. If I was going to drink, you had to go down to the bottle shop to buy something. I didn't have anything. And when I think about mine and G's first year of marriage, we didn't have alcohol in the house either. Like, it was only, oh, we're having a dinner party, oh, we'll go and buy some wine. But we just didn't drink like that during the week. And I do think something changes as you age, where, you know, there is that thing of having kids and then suddenly there's alcohol in the house because you're not going out and, you know, you're doing a lot more home entertaining. And, yeah, I just keep reading all these things about women and drinking. I can't help but agree, because when I look at my friends and their lives, it just seems there is a lot of culture about having wine. You know, I think about my mum and I every Friday afternoon used to drive to her friend Mel's, and they would, you know, have a glass of wine while my dad was at the pub, and, you know, that Friday Australian culture, right? If they'd both finished a work week, yeah, and whatever. But my mum would never then come home and have more wine with my dad, or, you know, drink more. She definitely drank a lot less than what I see happening in my...
In your house? Yeah. In your hand?
Well, you know, like, I'm not going to drink tonight because we had friends for dinner last night and, you know, I had, you know, wine then. But for me not to drink, because it's the weekend here, for me not to drink at the end of the week for the weekend is a big deal, you know, which is kind of sad.
Yeah, but you drink more, say you have a couple of glasses of wine, but then does that just make up for all the binging you did when you were younger? Like, are you levelling out on the number of glasses a week?
I hope so. I don't know, because, I really don't know. I'd love to get other people's perspective on it as well. And I wonder if it's worth doing a podcast on expat drinking. Actually, as I'm drinking saying that, I really want to do that. I'd love to do a poll on, did your drinking habits increase or decrease, or what it was like? Because, you know, there's always that theory about people who go to countries where alcohol is banned and they end up drinking a lot more and a lot harder liquor because it's suddenly not accessible. Do you know all those countries where people are having flash in their cornflakes for breakfast because they've developed a bit of a problem? Don't know. Anyway, completely off track, but I'm going to... I'm definitely going to go to the Facebook page now and ask the question.
Perfect. Okay. Thank you so much. We had one new review this week from iTunes from Me in Shanghai. So hi to Me in Shanghai on the UK iTunes. Said, great to hear what's happening everywhere in the expat world. I'm now downloading the back catalogue as I only discovered at the beginning of season 4. So yeah, lots of listening for you there, Me in Shanghai. Good luck with that.
Yay.
I hope the Chinese internet helps you out.
Yes, I hope so too. Now, Nikki, I'm thinking I'm going to go onto the Facebook page and I'm going to ask people about their drinking habits as expats. And I would love it. Please, please, people, if you have a thought about this or a story to tell about expat drinking, please go to twofatexpats.com and leave us a message and tell us about your story of expat drinking and whether you think it's gone up or down or what you notice about other people's drinking cultures. We would love, love, love to hear from you. And Nikki, I think that's about it for this week, isn't it?
I think that's up for this week. That's correct, Kirsty.
Okay. We'll see
Hamburg you. Out.
Bye.